start?
Yes.
Yes. Good. So I'm Jim Hanley, and welcome, Dr. Mietnin, to this, on behalf of the Journal of Epidemiology, to this interview. As you know, the plan is that the responses you give to the 13 core questions and any amplification of those will be printed in the journal. And I'm hoping the journal will also be generous enough to see the point of maybe making space for answers to additional questions that I have on slightly different topics. But I don't know what's going to happen with that. We're just producing the source document at the moment, and I see the epidemiologists wanting to have a source document to keep. The purpose, as I see it, is basically here to get your views on things that may not be evident or covered in your writings, the extensive writings, and in your addresses to congresses and so on. And also, of course, to put your in perspective your half century of serious work in this field. The half century, by the way, I'm counting, doing the numbers as a good epidemiologist, 25 or 6 of them have been here at McGill University, right?
Quarter century.
Quarter century.
One-third of that.
One-third. And at Harvard before that?
From 66 to 86.
Two decades. Two decades there. Very good. But obviously, looking back, I also want you to look ahead to what you think is in store or should be in store for epidemiology and for our profession, and your advice for the next generation on how young people should prepare themselves for a career in our profession. Okay, so let's start. The first question that the journal wants me to ask is about your entry into epidemiology, but I want to go back to your entry into the world itself. And it's going to be on the web what your age is. You were born in 1936. Okay, so you're coming up on 75. So if you could tell us a little bit about yourself as for nature and nurture, if you know what I mean, and other early influences. And let me be more specific. How much education did your parents have, for example?
My father had his doctorate in theology, of all things.
Wow.
My mother was a teacher, and my aunts and teachers all around. Yeah.
I see.
And so it was a home of education. My father was the head of the high school section of the State Board of Education.
With a degree in a doctorate in theology?
You bet.
What did he hope to do with it when he got started?
He was going to be a professor, but he got distracted to education.
I see. And how comfortable was your childhood?
This was
before the war, right? During the war.
I was really born in my conscious aids to war
Is
circumstances.
Right? Yeah.
And so we were in the countryside. Father was at war, and it was great.
Father was at war?
Oh, sure.
India. Okay.
So it was great deprivation in every way.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to Helsinki in 1944 when I was 8 years of age.
Okay.
And studied my formal education late in that way.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And are there many siblings?
We are a total of 7.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So it was a deprived childhood in the sense of the material things
of
life.
Oh, very much. Very much so.
Yeah.
And further, now that you ask essentially about happiness.
Yeah.
Oh, I did not like the theological environment.
I see.
It was too stringent and limited to my taste.
I see. Okay. Now, others that have been interviewed in the series have mentioned an aptitude or liking for mathematics. I imagine you liked it too, did you? Was it one of your favorite subjects or a subject to be
mathematics
tolerated?
And physics.
Physics, okay.
My teacher of physics turns to the class and says, "You people should take interest in this subject like I and Mietinen do."
Oh.
Mathematics. And in fact, my first academic endeavor was technological physics. And my livelihood was a matter of teaching mathematics.
I see.
Subsequently to those who were applying for the technology school.
I got you.
So mathematics has been very much a preoccupation.
And not alone that, is it a prerequisite, serious mathematics a prerequisite for our profession, or are you overtrained in that sense?
I am broadly of the mind that whereas in physics, a physicist uneducated in mathematics without serious education in mathematics is unimaginable.
Yeah, yeah.
But in medical science, to my great consternation, really,
yeah,
you can be a scientist without education in statistics. You delegate such a central thing to a lateral profession.
I see.
That shouldn't be. There should be the integration of statistics with the rest.
Okay. Now, the other prerequisite, I would think, is languages or language. Which languages do you have a good reading knowledge of?
Mother tongue, of course, is Finnish.
Right.
Swedish was an official language.
Yeah.
So one had to develop fluency in Swedish.
Mm-hmm.
I did get to be quite fluent in German, which was a good part of the medical textbook's content.
Oh.
And I still communicate in German.
Mm-hmm.
Now, French, only a tiny bit of exposure. I liked it, but I did not go deep into it.
Mm-hmm. But you could read it, Nick?
I can pretty well read professional content.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I had a teacher come to my house on Saturdays in Boston to teach me French. But then one day I asked, why am I doing this?
Okay. Was that
so? Yeah. I was still in Boston.
In preparation for coming.
No. Before.
Oh.
And so, I in life often ask, "Why am I doing this?"
Yeah.
And the answer was vanity, so that in the restaurant you can speak with the garçon and so on. So I quit.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Which writers have most?
By the way, English, of course, was a major subject
of
study.
Yeah. From early on.
It was a bit delayed because there was a transition from German major to English major, and the textbooks were not available early on. But yeah, I took great interest in the English language.
Mm-hmm. I know that, yeah. What writers have most influenced your style of your own style of writing, if you have any that you'd want to mention? And in English or in German or any other?
Well, English is what matters.
Okay.
And I cannot say that I develop style from some particular author, but I take a great note of their way of writing, nevertheless.
Yeah.
And I try to improve my writing, but as you know, so often readers say that it is difficult to capture my writing's meaning. But of course the question is, where's the problem? Is the problem in the writing or is it in the reading? Some of these things require a certain level of preparedness to even seriously read. And so I am open to guidance as to how to write better, but I am as serious a writer as anyone that I can think of from the point of view of the flow of the content, the logic of the presentation.
Now, after high school, you've mentioned some of this already. After high school, was there army service?
Yes, there was.
There was, which you had to do?
It was compulsory, yes.
And then, so you didn't go directly, you went from high school to army, and then to...
I went to technology, the technological physics for a year.
Right.
And then I went to the military and then to medicine.
Oh, okay.
And a tremendous difference between technology studies and medical studies. In technology, you really have very serious studies of very substantive content.
Right.
And in medicine, you just lean back as though sitting in a train and waiting to get to the end station years down the pike.
I see.
So leisurely as for any intellection.
Yeah. But given that, why did you choose medical school and switch from physics? That wasn't your father,
when in technology, I had this thought that whereas as a school kid, I had always been told by others that this boy will be an engineer.
Right.
Because he was so into technology, inventions, endeavors, and constructing things, that it was an outside idea that he is going to be an engineer. And classmates, half a dozen of us, went to technology. Nobody went to medicine. So it was a little bit of thoughtless sort of submission to expectations.
I see. Yeah. But then coming back from the army, you went to medicine,
yeah.
And was that with the idea of being in medical research or being a clinician?
The thing was, and I think it today still is, that when you enter medical school, there is no telling as to what you will do when you grow up.
Right.
There are so many lines of endeavor that I was quite uncommitted, other than I was going to be a physician, practitioner.
You were?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. But
seeing individual patients, you mean?
Yeah, but then I was drawn to research as a medical student, and that gave me the impulse to actually something else.
That's we're coming up now to the first question the journal has posed you, and that is indeed to describe your own path, how your own path brought you into epidemiology, how you went from medicine in general to epidemiology in particular. So might you give us some sense of that?
Yeah, as a medical student, I was drawn into research in a private hospital setting and foundation engaged in cardiologic research. And I got this strong impression that something is fundamentally wrong in this research, that these researchers, medical people from professor on down, while they were concerned with statistics suitably entered into their papers, they had no interest in what these statistics are and what they mean and so on. There was just a way of entering them into your paper like the other papers that you read something. And the
it hasn't changed.
And the statisticians would be in an other institute.
Okay.
And they would get the data and produce these statistics to be somehow worked into your article. I thought that this divorce between the substance and the statistics was just inappropriate, wholly inappropriate. And so either I leave academic medicine, which is what I was headed for, or I become a student of these very things. And after some consternation and contemplation, I elected to set out to try to learn theory of medical research, notably applied medical research.
Okay. And then that
And I was advised then to go and study epidemiology and biostatistics.
In Minnesota?
Well, that was the principle. Epidemiology and biostatistics is what you have to do.
Right.
Now, if you want to do it right, you go to those United States of America. Mm-hmm. And I did that.
I see. To the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Yeah. To a program which had both epidemiology and biostatistics in the one department? Or
no, separate departments.
Separate. And it was called biostatistics at that point?
It got to be biometry later on. So when I got my PhD, the department was already biometry. It was biostatistics when I entered.
It was. Okay. So that, okay.
Yeah.
Was there extensive coursework and mentoring at the University of Minnesota? Or would you consider yourself to be self-taught, if you know what I mean?
Well, let me answer that by saying that once I was done with my education, I took every course in epidemiology and in statistics, biostatistics included, and some lateral courses in genetics and so on. And at the end of it, I had the same feeling as I had at the end of medical school. I have spent this time here studying something, but I have not learned that which I have studied. Medical school, I was officially the top student, but I felt I did not learn medicine. I had my PhD in biometry and epidemiology minor, and I felt that I had not learned the principles of such the research as I was concerned with,
mm-hmm.
so that it remained a matter of future development rather than having been
you're,
in the bag.
You're all ready to go.
Education.
Yeah.
That to me is a problem that education fails to educate.
I see. What epidemiology?
I'm not saying that they were any worse than anybody else.
Right.
It's just the
nature of the
beast.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what epidemiology textbooks were available to you during your graduate study?
The more advanced book was that of McMahon, Pugh, and Ibsen,
mm-hmm.
1960, Epidemiologic Methods.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And statistics hasn't changed that much, so the...
No, not that much. And there was peculiarly then nothing in the nature of epidemiologic statistics,
mm-hmm.
or, if you will, clinical statistics. You would have bioassay and you would have sampling theory and
right.
things like this, but nothing by way of statistics as it pertains to a certain line of research other than bioassay.
Right. But you did tell me that you were one of the first to carry Mantell's work from Minnesota, where you probably encountered it, to Harvard.
But
and
that
others.
Was not from my teachings. It was from my
For
own,
sure.
own
yeah, yeah.
studies.
Exactly. But he and was one of the first to get into epidemiologic statistics, I would say. Right?
Who was?
Mantell.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In the 50s already.
Yeah.
In the 70s, Mantell said to me that you are the only one who really understands the Mantell-Hensel test. You know that the competitor was the Cochrane test.
Yes, exactly.
But the Cochrane test had a flaw, notably in respect to very thin strata,
yeah.
such as matched pairs,
yeah.
where the error is by a factor of two.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but Mantell evidently was frustrated with his test being ignored.
Yeah.
And when I came to Harvard, I brought the news about Mantell-Hensel to Harvard. Yeah.
Yeah. You also told me once a conversation you had with Mantell about the reason for the weights in the product, and how it was news to me that AD over BC itself, without any weight, would produce a sum of those over a sum of those would produce an unbiased median unbiased estimate.
Quite so, but the question is about the weighting.
Exactly,
you agree that his weighting was very ingenious.
Yes,
in that the product grows in proportion to the square of the total. And now you have to divide by the square of the total.
To get it right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Not the square, but the total itself.
Yeah. And just a footnote on that is that some years ago, Clayton worked out that, in fact, that formulation that he came up with has great theoretical rationale behind it. It's the first iteration on the way to maximum likelihood. It was turned out.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
So Mantell himself did not quite understand how profound
but
it was.
His instincts were outstanding. Yeah.
As he would have testified himself.
Oh, yes. He wasn't shy.
No, he was realistic.
Yeah. Now we're coming to the second one, which is the biggest difference between epidemiology that was practiced when you began your career and epidemiology today. What are the biggest differences?
Epidemiology as a concept remains confused as to whether it means practice of epidemiology, which to me is community medicine.
Okay, well, let's start with
that. Or epidemiological research.
Right, we'll start with the first.
But if we want to talk about practice of community medicine, the principal difference that I am concerned with is that increasingly we have this idea around that a citizen ought to take care of their own health in the interest of society. And healthcare increasingly encroaches on individual freedoms. In Nazi Germany, the citizen had the responsibility to take care of their health in the interest of the Reich. And we are in that situation increasingly today, and it bothers me as a libertarian.
I see, I see. Well, I remember when you came to McGill first, I remember you used to smoke a pipe.
Yeah.
You were pretty annoyed at some of the public health laws. Are you talking about tobacco smoking as one of those?
That's preeminent, but there are other things today, but that is surely the preeminent theme.
Right.
And it was in Nazi Germany.
I see, I see. Yeah, I remember in particular the business about smoking in your office. Might I ask how many years you smoked tobacco yourself? I know we shouldn't ask professors to profess about public policy at the same time.
But I can't be clear because it's so off and on kind of theme. As a youngster and medical student, everybody would smoke in the class, would you believe?
Right.
As a medical student.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the environment.
Culture. Yeah.
And then once the report came out in 1964, the Smoking and Health, and my professor quit from 2 packs a day to 0, so did I.
Oh.
I didn't smoke 2 packs, but
I
quit.
Yeah.
And so it's been so irregular that you couldn't get a smoking history out of me.
I see.
With
I
any
see.
Credibility.
I remember the smoke, the ritual of the with it. But I always thought when I grew up that a pipe smoker was a wise man. And that's what I remember you coming to McGill as, the pipe smoker.
Well, think of Einstein, for instance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Now, so you gave it up fairly easily?
Oh, sure. Mm.
Now, so you're telling me your smoking history wouldn't really make you eligible for the recent studies and screening for lung cancer then? You didn't smoke that much, did you?
Oh, no. No. But, again, I don't see any thresholds for eligibility.
I see.
If I were very health preoccupied, I would go and get screened, but I am not very health preoccupied.
I see, because you have a very good opportunity with the collaborators
good to be
you
sure.
have. But you never considered it?
No.
Do you think this screening for lung cancer should be covered by our Canadian and our Quebec healthcare system?
This is a question of public policy, mm-hmm. and public policy is not at all my line.
Mm-hmm.
And further, I have the view, and I am not by any means alone in this, that researchers should not express themselves in mm-hmm. respect to public policy. I asked Richard Doll about this, and he had a different view. He thought that a researcher should speak up about public policy, but I am in a different camp.
Mm-hmm,
I have
mm-hmm.
nothing to say as to society should or should not.
Well, I was going to ask you that later. So you don't think it's okay for researchers to be involved in public health policy then?
That's my point.
Yeah. Yes, but you spoke of your own professor giving up, and then you gave up. Brian McMahon said the same thing a few years ago, about 20 years ago now, about drinking coffee. He was very wrong, but a lot of people took notice of him at the time. So these public figures do have a chance to influence something and to do it, go wrong or go right. Yeah, so there's a big responsibility there, I think.
I don't know. It seems to me that there is no moral underpinning to somebody's lifestyle with respect to smoking or anything else.
The second, that was part one, which is epidemiology as public health practice or community medicine, right?
Mm.
Then the second one?
As for epidemiological research, since my beginning in epidemiology, the volume has increased enormously. But the question is, how much progress has there been in the achievements?
Mm-hmm.
As you know, today, the remedy for almost everything from the preventive point of view is diet and exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Question, what have we learned about diet and exercise in these 50 years? And I'm afraid not so much. So volume increase without a whole lot of progress in knowledge. That's my impression mm-hmm. about the change.
Along the diet and exercise line, a few years ago you lent me the book by Gary Tobes on good calories, bad calories, and I was very impressed by how extensively you had marked it up and how carefully you had followed his arguments. And I take it that you have pretty high regard for his work, do you?
There are two things here. I was very much preoccupied with cardiovascular disease mm-hmm. epidemiology mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as I was on my way to become a professor of cardiology back in Helsinki.
Right.
And so I went to these congresses and I followed everything quite closely and was really quite disappointed with, again, the progress. We could constantly listen to three main risk factors in these conferences, but no understanding of why the epidemic was rising and then turned to decline. Very frustrating. Now, when Taubes looks into the topic, he plows deep mm-hmm. historically in respect to matters, epidemiologic, geographic observations and whatever over the centuries. And he delves deep into the biology of atherogenesis and related things. And so the breadth and depth of his scholarship relative to what I think characterizes cardiovascular disease epidemiologists, at least in my experience mm-hmm. in those olden days, this to me was very impressive and to me shows how one should approach cancer epidemiology, for example, really understanding the biology and history rather than just recent epidemiological research. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so Gary Taub, who, by the way, is not
he's a science writer. That's right. Yeah.
But he does his work with diligence and depth and mm-hmm. breadth. Very impressive.
Now, I asked you about smoking and so on. What counsel do you follow yourself in the area of diet and exercise? I know you're a keen sportsman, but as for diet, does it matter or is it private?
I don't think of diet in my own case
yeah.
from the health point of view.
No, okay.
My aunt taught me that poor people's children are omnivores.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's switch now to the question of which person would you single out as having most strongly influenced your career?
There's no question. As you remember now, I, as a medical student,
yeah.
came to this idea that maybe I should study theory of medical research, and I consulted Martti Karvonen, my professor of physiology.
In Helsinki?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was the one who advised me to study epidemiology and biostatistics mm-hmm. and to go to the United States to that end. So he is the one person, obviously and eminently.
And there you encountered, that's where Ansel Keys was, right?
He was another physiologist.
Was he? Yeah. And he's one of the ones that Taubes is not too happy with, I think. Right? Yeah.
Karvonen collaborated with Keys on this seven countries study.
Right.
And the seven countries study brought us, I think, essentially two themes: serum cholesterol as something to worry about, mm-hmm. and the Mediterranean diet to think of as the preferable diet. Italy was one of the seven settings in that study.
Yeah.
And again, not a whole lot of progress since those early days.
No.
But yes, Taubes is highly critical of matters around this and many other matters in nutritional epidemiology.
Exactly. But I did hear you once describe Key's classroom teaching style.
Oh,
and it sounds like it was a joy. Huh?
Uniquely impressive.
It reminds me of your own a little bit.
Well, you are so generous here. But to teach based on your own research is unusual to begin with. But to do that with full presentation of what the critics are saying and answering your critics in class, this is a unique experience to me in my education. So whether he was right or whether he was wrong is beside the point.
Exactly.
The process was highly academic, as far as I'm concerned.
Are there any persons, one who put you on the path to epidemiology, are there any persons who've strongly influenced your thinking about the concepts of epidemiology and about principles and methods, which has been your own life career? Or again, is that mainly from yourself?
I have to say that the statistics from Mantell mainly surely were very strong exogenous influences. Cochrane also, who both of whom I knew quite closely in those early years. But as for epidemiological research, I had, as a PhD student already, considerable criticisms of what was said by my professor McMahon at Harvard in his book. So that it was clear that the development was very incomplete.
I see.
So I can't say that I have really had strong inputs from epidemiological thinkers.
Philosophers, maybe, but...
That's quite another thing.
Yeah.
Karl Popper, first and foremost, but many others.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, of course, philosophers can be very misguided. There's been a lot of nonsense.
Now, what have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration? I know this doesn't apply particularly to you as much as it does to some of the others who have been interviewed, but...
Well, my collaboration has been as a consultant, as an advisor, and in that role, it seems to me that the first order principle should be a deference to your client, your consultee, so that you are a student, a patient student of their own thinking as to what their topic seems to be and how they plan to study it, including really delving into their motives as to why they want to do this. And then again, you patiently, slowly lead them to formulate the object of study in a more detailed and in a meaningful way, and similarly the means of studying it. And I have this idea that ideally, in the end, your consultee would have the idea that they designed the study all the way without anybody's help. So you are there like Socrates, sort of guiding their thinking rather than imposing your thinking.
And... Stop the clock, yeah. Okay. That going okay?
Yeah.
I will take our time. I think we'll, you know, well, I think the beginning of stuff is
I understand
longer.
That you can...
Yeah, so with whom have you had the best collaborations then?
I must say with Herschel Gick, the father of pharmacoepidemiology. He was so impressive. Vast knowledge of pharmacology and medicine, for one. Great mastery of his enormous database, complex and voluminous. And commitment to excellence in everything, including making the very best of consultation inputs. And sort of an indication of this was the music that was continually playing in his office. Only Mozart was good enough. So that's what it was, without any exceptions whatsoever. Amadeus, God's beloved, was the only one who qualified. So that was an exercise in excellence and high academia, in my view. More than anything else.
In the research on lung cancer screening that I've alluded to, was your role as more a consultant or a collaborator there, I think?
There was an initiative in the thoracic medicine segment of Cornell Medical at that time, in the beginning of the 90s, where the concern was to find a common theme of research for the different specialties in thoracic medicine. And so they had a retreat in Snowbird, Utah, and they invited me to be an observer and analyst as to what's happening. And so as I had listened to the presentations from the different specialties, I diagnosed CT screening for lung cancer as being their shared concern, and they quickly adopted that advice. And I there already told them that I am not thinking of this in the ordinary epidemiological terms of a randomized trial, mm-hmm. but rather as a program of multiple clinical medical questions to be addressed as a complex program where you set out to do the screening and you develop the whole way of conducting the screening, and then you learn about its diagnostic consequences, and you learn about the prognostic consequences of such novel early diagnoses mm-hmm. that you arrive at. So I have been sort of the progenitor of the very idea
okay.
and its principles, and I have then been an advisor to them again almost 2 decades now.
Mm-hmm. And how satisfying has that role been?
It is a bit of a problem in that there is such a dogmatic epidemiologic commitment to those randomized trials on the mistaken notion that screening is an intervention. And so there is a lot of flack that comes then from the dogmatists. Mm. And this, by the way, James, you asked me about this thing on the wall in my office. Students have given me this thing that has Einstein's facade there, and underneath are these words as a quote from Einstein saying, and I am embarrassed to say that because I don't think of myself